welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. Over to you, Will.
Yeah, Will Gadsby-Pete, the other co-founder of Literal Humans. I'm very excited for this one. We invited our wonderful guest on the pod after I saw them speak at our conference that was otherwise quite dull. Rohit really stood out, and all the topics he was speaking about were awesome. So really excited for this one.
And as Will mentioned, we're joined today by Rohit Talwar, a global futurist and CEO and founder of Fast Future. Welcome to the pod.
My pleasure.
Well, first things first, just introduce yourself to the audience, who you are and what do you do?
So I'm a global futurist. I help governments, businesses, NGOs around the world to think about the forces and factors that might shape the future, economic, social, political, environmental, technological, etc., and to explore how they might play out, how they might interact. We don't do really predictions. We focus more on the kind of scenarios that can emerge. And then we use those to help those clients really think about how do we prepare for a range of possible futures so we're not surprised by anything that's happened. So right now, we have a little window where people remember the pandemic and they remember the impact of not being prepared and not having thought about cataclysmic scenarios. So they're more open to saying, well, this could happen again. And how would we prepare for it better? It doesn't matter whether it's an economic shock or a climate shock. There are all sorts of things that could disrupt us massively in the future. So how do we prepare for that? And how do we also prepare to take advantage of the mind-blowing advances coming, particularly in science and technology? So whether it's storing all of the world's information on a single kilogram of DNA, having artificial intelligence that's as smart as us or smarter within a decade, or having the ability to extend human lifespans by 50 years within the next 10 to 20. How do you prepare for that kind of world? And how do you rethink everything from the way you run society, to the role of money, to the way we interact with each other and how we govern?
I love that first of all, I think our audience is going to love this conversation. So I'm excited to dive in. One of the first news pieces that we share with you is from this from Nature, talking about robotics and AI and how it's going to help us expand our predictive capacities. I thought one of the most interesting bits of the piece was looking at climate forecasting, which obviously is near and dear to our hearts right now, and given the crisis that we're in. One of the notes in the piece talks about, and this is very important to us here in London, is the ability to predict precipitation. So they talked about this project from DeepMind, Google's sister company, where they're creating this nowcasting algorithm, and they're taking real-time rate our data to look at predicting precipitation levels in the next few hours, something that was very important. So curious to hear about how you're thinking about AI and robotics adding themselves to the climate forecasting toolkit and kind of what you're seeing out there in the field.
So I think on the one hand, it's absolutely incredible what we can already do with things that aren't AI at all. They're just really smart machine learning algorithms or things that can just process huge volumes of data and spot very quickly the paths to go down. And that's kind of what a lot of AI is doing now. We're seeing in all sorts of fields of science that AI is far outstripping our ability to do anything with it. So, for example, this article predicts in a very near-term way precipitation. Mm-hmm. We'll also be able to do that with air pollution. We can do that now with predicting disease outbreaks within 20 minutes of a change in population behavior, simply by monitoring what goes into their toilets, what goes into the sewers. We can monitor that second by second. So if you've got COVID, the fastest way of us knowing is by monitoring that. This is fantastic. The problem is that we as humans are almost genetically incapable of knowing what to do with that, because all of that requires us to be able to make decisions at speed, and more importantly, to allocate people and other resources. And we're so constrained on those things. We're so mentally constrained in terms of how things work. And we're so structured into our organizational silos that we can't actually do anything with that. So if I was to tell the Prime Minister tomorrow that London was going to flood in an hour's time, he wouldn't know what to do with that. It would be like telling the Mayor of London during the Second World War that you were about to be blitzed. And every single time you were going to be blitzed, he could do nothing. other than say get a tin bucket and put it on your head.
You sort of nailed the follow-up question I had, which is, do you think that will lead to behavioral changes? But I guess thinking more long-term, do you think we'll start to build those systems in place when we have this data that allows us to kind of see ahead?
Without being negative, if I was to say yes, that would be a victory for hope over experience. I think in order for us to deal with this world, we have to first accept that it's changing and that the people in power and the people we give decision-making authority to don't get it. And until they own up to the fact that they don't get it and that they need to evolve their thinking and they need to learn from the people who are creating these science and technology developments, the people who are coming up with the most incredible ideas with Web3, with metaverses, with NFTs, with AI, and in fields like the biological sciences, until we get our heads around what they're doing and what it enables us to do, those in power are always going to be behind the game and falling further and further behind because they have less and less understanding of these things and how they're interacting. So our biggest challenge today isn't about doing more progress in science and technology. That will happen. We have Web3 developers, blockchain developers, people who over the course of the weekend are building an application and launching it faster than we can even explain to people of my age what the thing means. Mm. So we're in a world where there's just a gap, like the nerdverse has emerged and it's growing ever faster, but kind of old world hasn't got it. So our biggest challenge today is getting that attitudinal shift, that mindset shift that says, look, it is perfectly fine to have an emotional reaction to what you're hearing, to have a feeling of no longer being relevant, and to then raise lots of false intellectual objections. Those are perfectly natural human responses which are designed into us, but they're also perfectly useless because they're not going to stop anyone else doing what they're doing.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if we're headed towards a different way to ask the question, maybe as like a technocracy. And you think about this with the pandemic where we had Sage and listening to the scientists and creating public policy kind of on the fly based on this somewhat real-time data we were getting from the pandemic. And I'm wondering if we can apply that to climate science, if we can apply that to other areas, and if government could ever be so nimble as to structure itself that way and respond.
Well, a couple of things went on there. So firstly, the models were based on a prediction of disease spread and the behavior of people moving around and a few other things. What they didn't factor in was the competition between scientists for funding. And so who got money quickest in the pandemic to do more research and to fund the next 20 PhDs on their program and to get their papers published in Science or Nature. And we mustn't lose sight of that. That's human greed. That's human behavior. But they also couldn't factor in that combination of things that the pandemic showed in our leaders. One was abject greed, the phenomenal desire to aggrandize themselves. And hopefully I'm not going to have my flat shut down by some politician, but their willingness to game the system, their reluctance to take the really big decisions quickly enough, and their, if you like, playing the game for the headlines of the newspapers rather than for the benefit of society. And so you couldn't factor all of that into the SAGE models or anyone else's. And then, again, that funding thing meant that there were a whole bunch of people who might well have agreed with them if there was nothing at stake. If there was, if it was all done in a closed room and nothing would ever leave the room, there would have been a lot more agreement.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be there on everything. So every time I sit in a debate now about artificial intelligence, I kind of count, you know, there's about 30 seconds before someone takes a deliberately contrary opinion, not because they believe it, because that's how they get attention. And I don't think we're going to engineer that out of society. And I hope we never do, because then we'll just stop being humans. And the technology can then decide that we're a waste of resource and space and get rid of us.
Speaking kind of to one of the points there, moving governments and to some extent companies as well needing to move much more quickly. One of the other pieces we shared with you was looking at like the transparency on algorithms affecting AI, in, as you said, very, very smart machine learning models. And the piece was sort of a bit of a debate on like, do you try and drive these to be more open source, or do you try and accept that they're going to be created and worked on behind closed doors, but there's a certain level of ethics and oversight within that room. And the piece, you know, didn't really come down definitively on either side. And it was saying right now we have a bit of the worst of both worlds, where some stuff's open source and very smart, but with no ethical strings attached, people can do some really scary shit with it. And then there are also some closed rooms where you have no idea what Google's DeepMind is doing with certain elements. You know, for the most part you do, because they tend to publish it. But how would you see that element there, like open source versus built in privately? How can that help governments and affect policy that it is a little more nimble? Should it be a case that everything's built out in the open, or does that bring open its own whole world of new risks and problems?
So to take what you've just said, and imagine you've just said that to Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman, who are probably the two key people here, because the Home Secretary is responsible for privacy and security. That's a huge thing. And the Prime Minister is theoretically responsible for everything. How much of what you just said would they even understand? Or would they even understand that they need to understand? There's a real challenge here, which is people think that if we say we've got explainable AI, it's like we've sprinkled fairy dust on it. And what does that mean? Does it mean that you can see what fired, what are the stages that the data was manipulated through? Great. How many people are going to be able to read that and understand it? And how many people are going to understand the training of that algorithm to go through those kinds of steps? And how many people are going to be able to challenge it and go, well, hang on, you've got to force outcomes there. But I think until people know what to do with something like that, and that's where you could bring it to life maybe. So I think it's a bit of a red herring. I think it's a red herring generated largely by people in the industry, because they want us obsessing about explainability so we don't look at what they're doing over here in terms of how far they're moving, how much they're abusing our data, and how far they're moving. So I think we should be much more focused on raising people's understanding of what these technologies are, raising their understanding of how to assess what they're doing, and then raising their ability to actually participate in a debate and push back and use our elected officials to push back to say, look, yes, you can do all this work with AI and these other technologies, but there are two requirements. One is you give the IP over to public ownership and then you get a rent back for using it. And second, you are completely transparent on your R&D pipeline, so we know the scariest shit that you're working on. And then you end up with a different model. And then you can start to bring in concepts like decentralized autonomous organizations, where the tech companies can put forward their R&D plans, or anyone, and then a massive community vote on them, and you start to get a self-regulating system. So you're not preventing scientific progress, but you're bringing a previously unimaginable level of transparency. And once we get that data is the equivalent to air, like data will run our world, and unless we get it, the creators of data, you and I, and the businesses that create it, will lose complete control to the aggregators and collectors of data. And we pretty much have to push back on all capitalist thinking at the moment if we want true transparency and we want true participation in society, because it means you have to move ownership out of the hands of the few and make it a public good. If you buy into the premise of artificial general intelligence, where we're creating AI that's as smart as us, that we will have true abundance with AGI within a decade at the latest, and we could get to artificial superintelligence, which is smarter than us, a few years after that. If you get that, then we literally can generate abundance in everything, because they will create fields of science that we couldn't imagine. They'll crack all sorts of problems like hunger, disease, anything you can think of. We could get to the point where in 25 years, we'll have forgotten that we were talking about climate change. We'll have changed ourselves so much, we'll have forgotten we were talking about hunger and energy poverty and all sorts of things, if we get it right. But that's a massive leap, and we need to understand how powerful these things are and then think about what's the framework in which we govern and enable those things. So we're moving at such a pace that unless we raise societal understanding, we'll have the technology capability over here, but a society trying to bring a wholly different mental model to how you work with it, govern it.
Quick requisite follow-up from a former educator. Where does this public education campaign live, for both for leaders and for the general public?
So there are a couple of examples in the world where people are inching towards it. So Finland has this solution called the Elements of AI, where they've created 6 modules to basically introduce the whole population online for free to AI. And I think it's 2 or 3% of the population have been through it. Now, you put that in context, we're in the UK. That would be 1.8 million people, maybe 2 million, actually, if you did the maths. I don't think 2 million people in the UK understand AI right now. Singapore giving all sorts of educational credits to people to learn about technologies and to encourage them. But we haven't seen that mass shift that actually says, look, you need to be investing time in this. You need to take control of your own destiny and we'll encourage you. So we'll maybe give you a rebate on your tax, charge you less if you go through these modules or you demonstrate you're learning about these things. Finding ways of really getting people to do the learning and finding ways of putting it into the school curriculum. Mm. And that requires the teachers to understand it. So it's not something you can crack overnight. We need to be thinking on a 5, 10, 15 year basis of how you transform society, but how you accelerate some of the earliest bits so people even understand that they need to understand this. Mm. And then start to learn how to learn, and then you can build all this other stuff in.
It kind of is a nice route into the last article, and you kind of already covered it in your answer. This last article looked at exponential growth, and like it talks about like how basically every 10 years it becomes 100 times cheaper to compute things. And so every 10 years, what used to take sort of like slow, steady growth is now an insane sprint where we think 10 years ago about the technology we had and it's laughable. Whereas before that, it took 100 years to get from the steam engine to the, you know, the petrol engine. And so basically everything is accelerating very, very quickly. And in the world of tech, it's accelerating exponentially. So every year it's like compound interest. And one of the things in the article it talks about is like the complexity of regulating that at the government level. To your point, even understanding it, it's like there are 2,000 people in Silicon Valley that understand a couple of the most cut bleeding edge tech products. How the hell do you regulate that? How the hell do you teach people about that? And so, yeah, just super interested to get your take on how do you shift that society to be able to deal with exponential growth in tech, in societal change? And, you know, like some of the examples in the piece truly are mind-boggling, like you've shared. Like, we could live in a world in 40 years where climate change is like, oh, do you remember that, guys? Like, what a mad thing that we all lived through, the same way that my mum remembers rationing from the war. Like, it's just a fun little thing that we all got through because we've created technology that's so powerful it can just solve it. So, yeah, how in your mind can we shift that from something as archaic as the British political system to a point where we can be nimble on our feet and react to stuff, you know, happening a month at a time rather than a year at a time, a decade at a time?
Fascinating question. And it's a really interesting challenge because in order for people to get the truly sort of massive game-changing potential of these things, you can't just go there, right? You have to give them examples. Mm. So you can start to say, well, okay, with something that's 100 times more powerful, we can do X and Y. So for example, some of the stuff we're working on at the moment, automotive. Some of the automotive component manufacturers are saying, stop paying us. Right. We'll provide the inventory. You put it into the car. There'll be sensors on everything. You know roughly what proportion of the total value of the car comes from us, from our components. The same for everyone else. So why don't you just give the cars away and charge the drivers per second? Stick digital advertising panels on the side of the car. So when you drive past the area I live in, you know, you might be advertising pound shops. You get to Chelsea and you're advertising Lamborghinis. But there's a whole set of revenue streams that car generates. And then that can provide a revenue stream back to the car company who then distribute that to everyone. And you need absolutely no human involvement in that because you can run it with a fully automated blockchain-based solution. So it's totally transparent. All of its smart contracts triggered second by second to move the money around. Even explaining that to someone, I watched their eyes roll over. I watched them look at their watch. I watched them thinking, okay, two options here. Can I just punch him in the face so he stops talking? Or B, can I tell him that, you know, there's an emergency that I've got to deal with? Because it's bigger than a brain full. And so then you have to keep dumbing down the examples till they get it. And then they go, well, that's not much different to what we already do. So you've dumped it. So again, you have to kind of accept that you can't do all this overnight. Like if we talked about exponential technologies 20, 30 years ago, we wouldn't be worrying about that now. So we just have to accept that there's a quite a long adjustment period, but there's certain things we can do now. And quite often that's by showing people these things in operation and just showing how different they are and then gradually opening them up. But also we need to open up their desire for this. The OECD shows that there's been almost no return on investment in technology for the last 20 years, other than to the investors in those companies. Right? So you see the amount that Microsoft, Google, let's not talk about Facebook. You see that the creators of the technology have generated immense wealth and their shareholders have. But that hasn't been reflected. You very rarely see any company say that we have achieved these better results because of our investment in technology. And that's why 60 to 80% of digital transformation projects fail, because people don't get it. The other thing we can do is to move a different generation into leadership, into decision making, and then take the current people in those roles and make them mentors. Because they have experience, they understand humans, they understand all those things. I would love to see the idea that that 100 times improvement in tech productivity had taken the planet out of poverty. Now, the reason that hasn't happened is nothing to do with the tech. It's to do with choices we've made as society. And those like we're all obsessed at the moment with carbon and, you know, CO2 emissions, and Gutierrez stood up and said, we're on the highway to hell and you lot have got your foot on the accelerator pedal. Great headline. But then everyone just says, oh, we should maybe buy some more carbon offsets, which is this giant mythical word where theoretically I'm emitting carbon over here and I need to offset that by someone else absorbing it. So I pay money into an offset scheme. Theoretically, I buy a bit of a forest or something, a peat bog or whatever, and that's absorbing as much carbon as I'm emitting. But the reality is there's no link. No one is monitoring those trees properly, and no one is ensuring that those trees don't get sold 10 times over. Very loose relationship.
Yeah. We'd love to dive into exactly how you do this work and, you know, with Fast Future and how you got started, what your inspiration was, and if you could, any success stories that you've seen from your initial work with Fast Future and how's it going?
Yeah, so I started out, I guess, as any other kid, kind of obsessed with tech that was around me, partly because we were like crazily poor as a family. My parents would never have admitted that, but we didn't really have very much. So I'd go to school and I'd see these kids having other stuff. And then we got a telly and I kind of saw, you know, Tomorrow's World and all these things. And I saw the moon landing and I kind of got obsessed with this idea of, wow, we could go to another planet. And so that stuck with me, did electronics and computer science at university, was always interested in the next and what happens after that. Went into consulting and was working for what was Arthur Andersen, became Andersen Consulting, is now Accenture. I went into artificial intelligence first, working for British Telecom as was BT. And it was fun. But you got the sense that the people around me didn't really want to do anything. And then I went, as I said, to Andersen Consulting. And there, what you discovered very quickly was that people were building things for the future with the assumption that the future would be like the present and the past, and you could just extrapolate. And so I started to explore what else is there that could help you think about the future differently. And I'd also changed jobs by then, so I had more freedom to look at some of this stuff and eventually decided that the best way to do it was to leave and do it myself. So got into consulting around some of this stuff, then doing research of our own, and then publishing books, and the speaking just built and built and built. So I guess the biggest impact I tend to have is when I do speeches. So I think my favorite story, though, was a few years ago, I was at a workshop in London, it's 2019, a workshop for the professional speaking industry, and it was being run by someone I know. And another woman whose name I was aware of, but I didn't realize the relationship between them. I didn't realize they were married. And I walked into the room and she just ran up and hugged me. I said, great. And she said, all right, I want to thank you. And I said, why? And she said, well, you won't remember this, but you spoke at this ASAE conference like back in 2009 or something. And you talked about people living routinely to 100 and beyond. And you said, imagine thinking about your partner and waking up next to them every day for the next 40, 50, 60 years. And she said, as soon as you finished, I called my husband and said, we need to speak. And she said, I got back and just told him that I couldn't sit next to him for the next 50 years. Could we get a divorce? And she actually married this guy that I knew. So now a lot of my consulting role when I work with clients is more of a therapist, where we talk a little bit about what's changing. We talk an awful lot about how they feel about it and how they can overcome their personal issues.
What's the process like of being on that absolute bleeding edge of understanding what is going on in the world of tech and what developments are happening, and then being able to sort of war game scenarios of what that tech is going to impact on the world, and then be able to deliver critical insights on it? Because, you know, that is really unique. Like, you're talking about how these people you're talking to, they're set in their ways, they're very scared of change, often at an emotional level. How do you kind of like get away from that fear of like traditionalism and conservatism and really deliver like, this is the cutting edge and this is maybe some of the stuff that's going to come out of it?
So there's lots of techniques to help you scan, identify what seem to be the most important factors, and also the wild cards and the weak signals of what might be changing, and to help you pull them together, make sense of them, look at how they might interact, and then combine them into scenarios and kind of look at how you create some internal consistency with all these things. So that's one of the approaches. And then storytelling becomes a big part of that. A second part is realizing, and it takes a while, that you don't need to know everything. You don't need to be up to date on every single development, because you can break your brain trying, right? And you don't need to. You need to understand the broader patterns of change and the individual examples. Like, I defy anyone to know what's going on in Web3 across the entire planet, even in the last hour, right? It's moving so fast. And some of it is just people creating new language. So it's more about helping people understand the bigger picture of what these things enable.
You reminded me of one of our clients. They run a nonprofit based in the U.S. South, and they do a lot of work around like moving people through political change and economic insecurity and stuff like that. And they were talking about leadership. And one of the things they said is, you know, they have this concept of equity-centered leadership, where you kind of meet people where they are. And there's this quote about moving people through discomfort and uncomfortability onto the other side of that, so that they can make the change that they need to, and like the, how that is true leadership. And it just strikes me that like what you're talking about is a form of leadership that is like empathic and understanding. And you talked about coaching, and you talked about therapy even, stuff like that. And then getting them to the other side of, look, the present is really intense and there's lots of really tough things going on right now. But at the same time, I want you to sort of move to this place where you can start to think about the future and grapple with it and the implications of it. And I think that's really powerful what you're doing in terms of public speaking and your coaching and consulting. So
we have a partner in the States where we're bringing together their work in design thinking and collaboration, and our work in foresight and kind of foresight-driven change. And what we know from those programs is that you can't just dive in and start talking about the future and how to do a scenario. You've got to teach people first how to have a conversation.
Brilliant. Let's jump into the lightning round. I've got a few final questions here and short, sharp ones to kind of get to know you a bit more as a person. So first one to kick us off with, we've spoken a lot about some of the amazing problems that tech might be solving in the next few years. But what in your opinion is a problem that tech cannot solve for us, and why?
Tolerance. I'd say we're becoming less and less tolerant as a society. We have a bigger and bigger desire for instant solutions. So when the pandemic started, there was this clamor for an answer immediately as to what we could do with it. And then when we got the vaccine at breakneck speed because of 20 years of science that preceded it, then you had this intolerance that there might be a few adverse reactions. Mm. And we have that the whole time, that people have that. And I don't think tech is the answer to that. Tech might help us understand a bit more, but that's more about listening. That's more about compassion. It's more about being able to see a bigger picture. So it goes back to education. And it's more about seeing the value of having love for your fellow human.
You're going to love this next question. Intentions aside, what's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I guess I'm frightened by all the social nudge stuff, the surveillance and nudging you to do certain things. So we'll get to the point where when you get to these, like the Amazon Fresh and things, where you walk in, pick stuff up and take it out. Well, if you're diabetic and you pick up something with sugar in, what if we just don't let you leave the store until you put it back? Or we electrocute you when you try and pick it off the shelf? Mm-hmm. Right? How far will we go mm-hmm. with the tech to prevent you making bad choices? or to monitor your behavior. And we see that in certain parts of the world. We've got the social scoring systems, the nudge systems. And then I'm really scared by all the weapons technology.
Yeah.
These drones that can literally fire off thousands of bullets in a very short space of time, and you can't even see where they're coming from because the drone has come in from 2,000 feet up, delivered its payload and gone again before you know what's going on. And there are so many people who today feel so disenfranchised, you know, domestic terrorists, we're not even talking about, you know, international terrorists, who could use these things without batting an eyelid.
Yeah.
And that worries me, that there's almost no control on this. And because there's so much money to be made from creating these things.
Yeah, I think the power it puts into people's hands is at times cool when you see good examples of it, and then other times it's terrifying. Like, I always talk about the scary thing about Russia's interference in the last American election to help Donald Trump get elected is I could do it. Like, if you gave me the same budget and the same data they had with my background in performance marketing, I could have done that as a single citizen. And that's very, very scary. And that's like a stupid thing, like a social media platform's paid advertising mechanism. To be able to do it with drones and anything else is far more scary.
I know one of the people who was doing it.
Really?
Before Russia. And he actually quit because he didn't think they were doing it well enough.
Wow.
And he said, what you're doing is quite easily traceable. We could do this in a way, just a little bit more kind of design and thinking, we could do this in a way that would be almost impossible to trace. And he just got frustrated and quit.
Bloody hell.
What's he doing now?
I can't tell you. He has told me, but I kind of, no, you're not doing that. You're really not doing that, but he probably is.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, it leads us on to our next question. If you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve?
I think it would be something around the food chain, so that we could have much more visibility of what's going on with the food, manage it better. And I think it's a combination of technologies, actually. It's about better packaging that preserves the life of it, reduces its environmental footprint, allows us to get it to the people most in need, reduce waste, maybe prolong the time periods that we can do harvesting for. Now, that might involve genetic modification, but quite often it's about soil management, it's about crop management, it's about watering, it's about tapping into more natural cycles. So technology that helps you do that, I think, could be really, really effective. And anything that would really help in managing the food chain better and helping reduce food poverty, I think would be a good thing.
You're the first global futurist we've had on the podcast, so we're very pumped to ask you this next question. But what's your prediction for the tech space broadly over the next 12 months?
So right now in London, there's a massive explosion of people talking about their stuff in NFT, Metaverse, Web3, because it's huge. Well, not just one conference, but about a zillion going on this week. I think I can reasonably predict that pretty much of everyone who's talking about a venture this week, less than 1% of them will have succeeded. Most of them will have failed. Not because of them, but because 95 to 97% of all tech ventures fail. And if you look at these, they're being created at such speed by people who have great tech ideas, but not a lot of business acumen. So I think that ups the ante in terms of the likely failure rate. But the great thing is, it doesn't matter to them, because it's just another rehearsal. They'll do something else. They're not going to be put off by failing two or three times in the next year. And it is fun talking to them, because everyone believes that they really are the savior of the planet, whatever they're doing. And you want that energy, you want that excitement, you want that willingness to push the boundaries. And there's no point being a grey old fart and going, oh, you'll probably fail. Like, it's not going to get me invited to many parties. Yeah. But also, it's not going to help them.
Right. There's wisdom in that if they're open to exploring it, I feel like, you know, that prediction and the reasons for it, yeah.
Before we move on to the last question, just maybe more anything you think over the next 12 months we'll think of, like, you know, 2023 as the year that Technology X became very widespread.
I think one of the obvious ones is metaverses. Mm. So I would say if you're like a Fortune 500 company, even if you don't really, you'll say you've got some sort of metaverse presence. There's a very good chance that most of them will be horrible billboard versions of their website.
Mm.
Worse still, you might do something, and I hate this because I'll never get any work out of them, but what JP Morgan did when they launched Onyx, their lounge in the metaverse, or on a metaverse, where they had a tiger to greet you, because that's a cool thing to do.
Why?
Exactly. And then a portrait of their CEO, Jamie Dimon.
Creepy.
Creepy, and a massive why. And then a PowerPoint presentation about their thinking on the future of payments.
Okay, that just seems regressive. Why would you create a metaverse and then have a PowerPoint presentation?
Like, who are they thinking is the target audience for that?
The CEO.
No one.
That's a niche.
If they're thinking of like their traditional private banking clients, but they're not going to go in the metaverse to find out stuff. And so
it's like people who like tigers, portraits of CEOs, and
PowerPoints. And then on the other side, you get people who really get these technologies. I think a lot of the big companies will jump onto the metaverse. Not a huge number will get it. Some will do brilliant things. I think AI, everyone will be saying they've got AI in whatever they're offering. They already are. But I think probably this year or the next 12 months, we'll start to hear the term generalized AI, which isn't quite artificial general intelligence that's as smart as us. But things like Gato that can already perform 600 tasks in parallel and do 400 of them better than the equivalent human expert.
Last question here, and all of your answers over the course of the pod have kind of been a testament to this, but talk to me about how you've built a balanced kind of a career that balances profit and purpose, because it sounds like you really do love and believe in what you're doing.
Oh, I'd love to kind of stand up and ask to be, beatified and kind of made a living saint for what I've done. But the reality is we're all driven by the need to feed our families, raise our kids in a manner to which they should never have become accustomed. And so there is that part of it that I had to make enough. But I like to think that I'm having an impact by just talking to people in a really honest way about these things. So at the moment, I'm doing quite a lot of talking to the travel industry, saying, look, it's no longer fashionable to pretend that existential risk won't touch you. You've just been through one, right? Mm. So now we should be worrying about dangerous climate change. We should be worrying about economic volatility, and we should be worrying about technological unemployment, because that will take away people's ability to buy travel, but it will also take away the number of leaders and managers you have in business who might do business class travel. So you need to know this, right? So getting people to just kind of move from being scared of these things to opening up and saying, let me understand it, giving themselves permission to explore things. And I think that's probably my biggest contribution. Mm. It's kind of encouraging people to give themselves permission to explore the future. And then raising awareness of certain causes that I'm passionate about, like education, like protecting the planet, and tackling things like global poverty.
Yeah, that's such an empowering note to end on, like giving people permission, or encouraging people to give themselves permission to explore the future. Like that's, if you could walk away with that as your life mission, I mean, that's incredible. So thank you for that.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This has been another episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast by Literal Humans. We've been joined today by Rohit Talwar, global futurist and CEO and founder of Fast Future. Thank you so much for your time today, Rohit.
Thank you for having me.
And real quick, where can folks find you on the interwebs or in the metaverse?
The easiest place to find me is at fastfuture.com, and rohit@fastfuture.com is my email. And then, exist on a whole bunch of the social media sites. But those tools be a good start.
Amazing. Thank you, Rohit. Thank you, Will. And for our listeners, please rate us, subscribe, give us that 5-star rating. It'll help us bring great guests like Rohit onto the pod in the future. And Rohit, we'd love to have you back at some point to talk about the future in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.